This will be our third message on the seven church eras of the Old Testament and the New Testament. When we last left off, we were in about the year 311, 312, at the end of the 10 years of terrible persecution of the church instituted by Domitian and Galerius. Now we're at the time when Constantine takes the throne of the Roman Empire, in about the year 312. Though his army was far inferior to that of Maxentius, numbering according to various statements from about 25,000 to 100,000 men, Maxentius had 190,000, he didn't hesitate to march into Italy. So what happened is after the death of Galerius, who was a Roman emperor, there were three men who were appointed as successors. There was, of course, Constantine, Maxentius, and the third man was Licinius, L-I-C-I-N-I-U-S. Each of them were given a separate section of the Roman Empire by Galerius. And of course, very quickly, they began to each want to take over and become the Roman emperor, not one-third Roman emperor. Constantine marched on Rome in the year 312 A.D. The opposing forces met near a bridge over the Tiber River, which runs through Rome. The bridge was called the Milvian Bridge. And here Maxentius' troops suffered a complete defeat, the tyrant himself losing his life in the Tiber River on 28th October 312. Before the battle, the night before, Constantine said he looked up into the sky, or in the clouds, just in that kind of early morning hours, and saw a picture of a symbol and heard the words, conquer under this symbol or under this sign. Anyone know what that sign was? No, it wasn't really a cross. It was a P. It was a P with an X under it. And I know a lot of times we say it was a cross because it is a form of a cross. It is the Egyptian cross. But it's actually a P with an X under it because all of the shields and all the emblems of Constantine actually have this P with this X under it, which is essentially an Egyptian cross. They actually called it Christ's monogram. The soldiers of Constantine's army went and got a bunch of paint, apparently, and painted this monogram that he had seen in the sky on their shields. It's as though the majority of them were pagans. Of his gratitude to God, the Christians, the victor immediately gave convincing proof, and the Christian worship was henceforth tolerated throughout the empire. One of his first acts as being Roman emperor was to issue the Edict of Milan in early 313. From that time forward, no bloody executions followed, no Christians were persecuted, and no one was an enemy of the state because they said the word Jesus Christ or lived as Christians. Licinius then became the brother-in-law of Constantine. Constantine married Licinius' sister, and they actually had peace for a short time, but before long, Constantine found out that Licinius was planning on attacking him, so he sent his armies against the town of Byzantium on the Bosporus, in modern-day Turkey. Eventually, with a fleet of 200 vessels and a cavalry of 10,000, an army of 125,000, Constantine was able to defeat Licinius and then established his own base in 324 at the town that he renamed after himself and called it Constantinople. At that point, it was a very small town, and so he told all of his engineers and his builders to go stand on the edge of town and go as far from town as the gods could go in one day, and thereby build new walls. So the size of Constantinople became much larger than the size of Byzantium. Then he decided that people should live there, so he allowed people who lived in Constantinople to not pay taxes, and many of them to be exempt from military service. He gave them free land. And so thousands of people across the Roman Empire began to flood into Constantinople, and within 20 years, these outside walls that had hugely increased the size of the city were too small, and they had to build additional walls on the outside of that. Of course, we have now the year about 325, when Constantine is the emperor of a peaceful, at least fairly peaceful, Roman Empire. I'm going to read some today out of a book called The Story of Christianity by Justo Gonzalez. I borrowed this book from Howard Davis. He said he felt it was the best that he had found on early church history and even secular history during that time. We'll begin in chapter 13. We have left Constantine at the moment when, after defeating Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, he joined Licinius in ordering the end of persecution throughout the Roman Empire. Although we have already indicated that eventually he became the sole ruler of the Roman Empire, it now remains to follow the process by which he achieved that goal. So I'll skip a few pages here now. Constantine would reign for the next 13 years. He took over Byzantium and became the only emperor of the Roman Empire in 324 AD. Compared with the previous civil wars, this was a period of rebuilding and prosperity. There were always political uneasiness, and quite a few people were condemned to death for real or supposed conspiracies against the emperor, among them his own eldest son, Crispus, who had commanded his father's fleet in the war against Licinius. Constantine had not sought absolute power for mere pleasure of it. He also dreamed, like Decius and Diocletian before him, of restoring the ancient glory of the empire. The main difference was that, whereas Decius and Diocletian had sought that end through the restoration of paganism, Constantine believed it could best be achieved on the basis of Christianity. So Constantine wanted to use the name and the attractiveness of Christianity to then build a homogeneous Roman Empire, to where he could galvanize all the people together and keep them under his control and rebuild the glory that had once been Rome. Some of the staunchest opponents of this policy were in Rome, particularly in the Senate, where the members of the old aristocracy bemoaned the eclipse of their ancient gods and privileges. Several years before his final struggle with Licinius, Constantine had clashed with the interests of the Roman Senate. Now, as absolute master of the empire, he set out on a bold course. He would build a new Rome, an impregnable and monumental city, which would be called Constantinople, that is, the city of Constantine. So we have the city of Constantine being built as the Eastern Empire seat of authority for the Roman Empire. Continuing on about Constantine's conversion. The nature of Constantine's conversion to Christianity has been the subject of many debates. Shortly after the events told in this chapter, there were Christian authors, one of whom we shall meet in the chapter, who sought to show that the emperor's conversion was the goal towards which the history of the church and the empire had always been moving. Others have claimed that Constantine was simply a shrewd politician who became aware of the advantages to be drawn from being a Christian. Both interpretations are exaggerated. It suffices to read the documents of the time to become aware that Constantine's conversion was very different from that of other Christians. At that time, the people who were converted were put through a long process of discipline and instruction in order to make certain they understood and lived their new faith. Their bishop became their guide and shepherd as a way sought to discipline or discover the implications of their faith in various situations in life. Constantine's case was very different. Even after the Battle of Milvian Bridge and throughout his entire life, he never placed himself under the direction of Christian teachers or bishops. So we had for a couple hundred years in the Roman Empire the situation where there was this growing and established church called Christianity in the Roman Empire with the blessing of Constantine or later emperors, but those emperors were not subject to the church until the time of the beginning of the 1260 years. And we covered that a couple months ago as a time as the beginning of when we can compute the chronology of the beginning of, quote, the end times or the last days. The last days begin at the end of that time of the church being in the wilderness. And the signal for that, of course, was when the church became dominant over the Roman Empire's emperors. And that, of course, took place in the 500s B.C., AD. But here in the 300s, we have Constantine never placing himself under the authority or direction of Christian teachers or bishops. He had Christians such as Lactantius, tutor of his son Crispus, formed part of his entourage. Hosius, bishop of Cordova, became for a time his liaison with other ecclesiastical leaders. But Constantine reserved the right to determine his own religious practices and even to intervene in the life of the church, for he considered himself bishop of bishops. Repeatedly, even after his conversion, he took part in pagan rites in which no Christian would participate, and the bishops raised no voice of condemnation. The reason for this was that not only that the emperor was both powerful and irascible, but also that in spite of his policies favoring Christianity and his repeated confession of the power of Christ, he was not technically a Christian, for he had not been baptized. In fact, it was only on his deathbed that he was baptized. Therefore, any policy or edict favoring Christianity was received by the church as the action of one who was friendly or even inclined to become a Christian, but had not yet taken that decisive step. The truth is probably that Constantine was a sincere believer in the power of Christ, but that does not mean he understood the power in the same way which it had been experienced by other Christians. For him, the Christian God was a powerful being who would support him as long as he favored the faithful. Therefore, when Constantine enacted laws in favor of Christianity, and when he had churches built, what he sought was not the goodwill of Christians, but rather the goodwill of their God. So here we have Constantine rebuilding this Roman Empire using the church, or using the name of Christ and the power of Christ that he talked about quite often, but as sort of like making a deal. Remember, let's make a deal with Monty Hall. So Constantine says to God, well, God, if you'll make me emperor, then I will stop all of this persecution and all of the killing of all these Christians. So we have Constantine here using the name of Christ and the growing Christian church at that time, the established church, in order to put the Roman Empire completely under his control and to make it function again. One of his first acts after controlling Rome and becoming the emperor was to call an ecclesiastical ecumenical council. He called in 318 of the great bishops of the area, all across North Africa, the Middle East, the area known as Palestine, Asia Minor, Greece, Rome, and up into the areas of Europe. In AD 324, an imperial edict ordered all soldiers to worship on the supreme God on the first day of the week. So he ordered the first day of the week as the day of worship, and he also had this large council called a year later. The first day of the week was the day on which the Christians celebrated the resurrection of their Lord, but it was also the day of the unconquered sun, and therefore pagans saw no reason to oppose such an edict. So the pagans in Gaul and in much of the scattered Roman Empire already venerated Sunday, so this was simply one method that Constantine had in order to win their approval and gain them as being a part of homogeneous Rome. A year later, in 325, the Great Assembly of Bishops was later to be known as the First Ecumenical Council gathered in Nicaea. Now, this book says Nicaea was a port on the western edge of modern-day Turkey. So if that's the case, then the one at Nice in France was later. Apparently, there were two councils. So I mentioned that last week, and the authority I had before was certainly firm on that. But this one says at Nicaea, which I believe this is probably the more correct. That assembly was called by the emperor, who once again put the imperial post at the disposal of the traveling bishops. Let me go on down. The most immediate consequence of Constantine's conversion was the cessation of persecution. Until then, even at times of relative peace, Christians had lived under the threat of persecution and what was for many the hope of martyrdom. After Constantine's conversion, that threat and that hope dissipated. The few pagan emperors who reigned after him did not generally persecute Christians, rather tried to restore paganism by other means. Until Constantine's time, Christian worship had been relatively simple. At first, Christians worshipped in private homes. Then they began to gather in cemeteries, such as the Roman catacombs. By the 3rd century, there were structures set aside for worship. The oldest church that archaeologists have discovered is that of Dara Ephoros, which dates from about AD 250. This is a fairly small room decorated with simple murals. After Constantine's conversion, Christian worship began to be influenced by imperial protocol. Incense, which was used as a sign of respect for the emperor, began appearing in Christian churches. So here we have these Christian churches being built around Europe in the Roman Empire, and we find the influence of Constantine's Rome coming in very quickly. Much of that influence, of course, came from pagan practices. Incense had been burned in the Temple of Solomon as a type of prayer, but in the Roman Empire, it was burned in these buildings as a sign of respect or worship of the Roman emperor. Officiating ministers, who until then had worn everyday clothes, began dressing in more luxurious garments. So the practice of people who officiate at religious ceremonies wearing these big fancy robes and all sorts of regalia began during Constantine's reign, during the time when the church was then approved by the Roman Empire. Likewise, a number of gestures indicating respect, which were normally made before the emperor, now became part of Christian worship, where they would kneel on one knee, what we call genuflecting, and various little wavy things they do with their hands or whatever. You've seen some of that in some of the Roman movies made of historical Rome. Choirs were also developed, partly in order to give body to the procession. Eventually, the congregation came to have a less active role in worship. So here we have, in this history book and many other sources of history, what was happening at the beginning of the third church era called Pergamos. That was when the church began to be sort of married to or in alignment with the world. The word Pergamos actually means elevation or married to the world. It means this amalgamation where the world became accepting of the church, and the church also became accepting of the world. And during this time, we have a great falling away when a huge number of people who knew God's truth surfaced a few years later, keeping Sunday, teaching all sorts of pagan doctrines that came out of Origen and came out of Tertullian and came out of other early church theologians, and certainly turned away from the truth they were originally called to. I want to begin in the Bible today in 1 Samuel chapter 8. In the third era of the Old Testament church, we have a time when the time of the judges is over, and it's now time that is called by historians the United Monarchy. The Church of Pergamos was the longest-lived church of any. From 325, when Constantine made his edict, came to the throne and became the final emperor ruler of the Roman Empire of all of Rome, until the time of 1100 AD. So almost 700 years, 675 years, more specifically, the Church of Pergamos lasted. In the Old Testament, the Third Era only lasted through the reigns of three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, a time of barely 100 to 105 years, if you figure Saul's reign at about 25 years, 25 to 28 is what most historians figure Saul's reign as, then King David for 40, Solomon for 40, so roughly 105 to 108, 110 years at the most, for the time of the third era of the Old Testament church. What we find, though, is that during this time, Israel wanted to be like the nations around it. When we left off in the book of Judges, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. That means there was no God who was king. Jesus Christ was supposed to be their king, but they had rejected him also. So in 1 Samuel chapter 8, and verse 1, it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons didn't walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Now the idea of passing on rulership to your sons really has never been a good idea. You know, very rarely has it ever worked, has it ever been a blessing for the people who were then governed or ruled by those people. It does not work well in American business. Very, very rarely now do any CEOs leave their company to their sons or daughters because it's almost been a failure in almost every case. A few times it's worked, but in most cases it is not. And certainly in the Church of God, leaving a position to a son because of who they're a son of, not because of their biblical qualifications, has been an unmitigated disaster in our lifetime. Absolutely an unmitigated disaster. So it's not God's will. It was not the way that leadership in the ministry should have been chosen or carried out. But, of course, human beings, what they are, we tend to repeat mistakes of the past. So what we have here in verse 3 is sons who were not at all qualified to be judges of Israel except by who they were born to. And that wasn't the way God raised up judges. Look back to the earlier part of the book. All Israel came together to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Look, you're old, your sons don't walk in your ways. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Now, instead of fasting, asking for God's help, asking for God's will to be shown, and setting up a new judge, instead we now have, they say, "We want to be like the nations around us." They said, "Give us a king." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people and all they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them." So Samuel, it isn't you that they're rejecting, it's me. "According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they're doing to you. Now therefore heed their voice, however warn them, and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." So here we have this church in the wilderness, which now wants to be like the nations around it. They want to have a king, like the Moabites, like the Assyrians, like the Egyptians. They want to have a Pharaoh. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people, who asked him for a king. Verse 11, he said, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and appoint them for his own, chariots, be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots." So he'll have all these guys running around announcing, "Here comes the king, here comes the king." "He'll appoint captains over his thousands, captains over fifties. Set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest." So they become slaves. They'll work for the king. some to make his weapons of war and equipment of chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. Take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. So this king will simply steal what you have. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, give it to his officers and servants. He'll take, even in the place of God, he'll take tithes and take possessions from you. He'll take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, and put them to work. Take a tenth of your sheep, and you'll be his servants. Verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we want to have a king rule over us. People want to have a king, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us to fight our battles. And so then God allowed that to happen, even though it became friendship of the world, and the end result was not good. Now let's turn back to Revelation chapter 2 and begin with the story of the church of Pergamos, the church that begins about the time when Constantine the Great defeats Licinius and decrees Constantinople as his new capital of the Roman Empire. Pergamos, as we mentioned, means elevation or married to high, married to the world. The city was located about 20 miles inland from the city of Smyrna in northwest Asia Minor. It was the capital of the Roman province of Asia. It was noted worldwide for its science and medicine. It also had many magnificent statues of various pagan gods, statues of Zeus, Dionysius, Athena. Pergamos was largely pagan and heavily involved in idol worship. Some commentaries say they had brought physical idols from Babylon and put them ensconced in Pergamos. After the time that Constantine became the emperor over all the empire, Pergamos became famous for paganism, or at least for a seat of paganism and all of these temples of these various pagan gods. The city appears to have been a very difficult place to live as a Christian. There was also there the temple of Asclepius, who was a big being wreathed in a serpent. He was called by his followers the preserving savior. Pergamos had a large library, and for many years paper was simply called Pergamena because there were so many books in Pergamos. When Constantine became emperor of Rome, he ended persecution, but Pergamos then became an important center for Christianity, blending it with the temples and the things that were there, the religion that was already there. It existed as a very vibrant city until 716, when it was attacked by the Arabs. Its political and other power gradually fell into ruin. It's now simply a desolated area with a small town named Pergama where it once was. Pergamos is in Revelation chapter 2, in verse 12. To the angel of the church in Pergamos write, so God announces to the angel, to the messenger there, here is a message to the people in Pergamos. These things says he who has the sharp, two-edged sword. Now why does God say, look, I'm the one announcing a message, and you better listen to it, and the message is this two-edged sword? Well, hold your place there and go back to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12. Why is it that God has to remind this church era, I have the two-edged sword, and you'd better listen to what I'm going to say? Well, the answer is very simple. Because the story of Pergamos is a story of being married to the world. It was during this time, during the several hundred years, when many people left the truth and became followers of pagan doctrines. Followers of Arius, who didn't believe in the divinity of Christ. Followers of the Trinity doctrine, which came from Tertullian and Origen. Followers of keeping a different day than Passover, following doing things like keeping Easter, and of course, keeping Sunday. They brought into the two creeds, the creed from Nicaea, the Nicene Creed, and then later what was called the Apostles' Creed. Some of you may have memorized the Apostles' Creed if you were Lutherans or some other sinner-keeping sect, you know, in your younger years. So here we have in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12 what God means about this sharp two-edged sword. The Word of God is a living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit. So what he's saying is that I'm holding this sword, and this sword represents the difference between good and evil, separating light from darkness, clean from unclean. And though you may want to intermix clean and unclean, light and dark, evil and good, be a part of the world and also be separate from the world, you can't do it. God says, I discern even to the soul and the spirit, my word, my sword understands the truth all the way to the very inner core of your being. And of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. So the sword represents Jesus Christ being able to discern the thoughts and intents of your heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight. You can't pretend one thing and fool God. How many of us think we can fool God? Well, we all have at one time. We've all thought we could get away with something. You know, our kids always think they can fool us and get away with certain things. We all did as we were kids. But sometimes we find that mom and dad knew a lot more than we thought they did. I think someday at the judgment seat, we're going to find that Jesus Christ knew everything, every thought and intent of the heart. And it says, all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. So we have this message over here in Revelation chapter 2 about this two-edged sword. The Word of God has the ability to separate Christians from the world and to judge and condemn the world for sin and separate light from darkness. But we have a church area here that is in the process of compromise. We need to understand very clearly that what became the Church of Rome and of Europe and of Constantine and what eventually became the church that rode the beast a couple hundred years later was a church that to begin with was made up from people who had become apostate from the truth. Many of these people understood the Sabbath, the holy days, the truth about Jesus Christ, about God's kingdom. And because of the allure of Constantine and because of the things that had happened during that time, they decided they wanted to follow along with the crowd and become a part of the established church of Rome. There probably were many there also who were opportunists. All of a sudden, after 100 and some years of persecution, now Christians are well respected, well thought of. In fact, they're going to be part of the governing or the ruling body. So no doubt that was attractive to people who said, aha, now I can have position. Now I can have a big house. Now I can have all the land I want. Now I can have whatever it is. So I will teach whatever Constantine wants me to teach. And so the apostasy of falling away from the truth, the great falling away, so to speak, one fulfillment of that occurred during this time. And of course, a very similar occurrence has happened even in our lifetime, where the vast majority of people who profess to know the truth and obey it once again turn back to the very same doctrines and false teaching that came out of the Council of Nicaea. Ideas like the Trinity, ideas like the immortality of the soul, ideas like keeping pagan holidays instead of God's true holy days, and certainly the idea of meeting on Sunday instead of keeping God's holy Sabbath. So we have seen in our time an example of what happened back then. So the message of Pergamos is very important to each one of us. Let's continue on now in chapter 2 of Revelation. After God says, he's the one who has a sharp two-edged sword. He knows what's going on, and he has that sword that will judge. I know your works. In other words, I know how hard you've worked. I know that as individuals you have done certain things to stay faithful. And that where you dwell is where Satan's throne is. All of these temples, the Dionysius, the Zeus, to the various other pagan deities that came from Babylon and throughout the Mediterranean world. He says, I know where you live. You live where Satan's throne is. And in fact, during the entire 700 years of this church era, Pergamos, we find that Satan's seat spread as that pagan religion took hold with a death hold or a chokehold on Europe. The people who wanted to follow God truly ended up hiding in the mountains, living up in the Piedmont areas of Italy, of France, of southern Germany, and essentially hid out in the mountains and the places that were not on the beaten path, that were not on the major highways, that were not in the major cities. And instead, they were sort of hiding and doing on their own. They weren't persecuted or killed pretty much, except for a few times like the Spanish Inquisition, which actually came a little bit later. But we have here at this time the church pretty much going into hiding, or at least into living somewhat separate. But they lived where Satan's seat was. The town of Pergamos was certainly that, and later as that religion spread, the church had to live with that influence all around them. He says, hold fast to my name, and did not deny my faith. So some of the people there held fast to his name, to God's name, and did not deny his faith, even though many did deny the faith and became part of the pagan church, the false church of Europe, that at this time was building very rapidly. It says, "You hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." So twice in this verse, the term is used, where Satan dwells. First, where Satan's throne is, and secondly, where Satan dwells. Now, Antipas is hard to kind of tie down because there's no definitive history on him. There are several commentators simply mention he was a specific person, but they don't know who. That apparently was a good example. There's one commentary I found that says he was the bishop of Pergamos, written about in a letter called the Acts of Antipas, and that he was burned to death in front of one of these pagan temples in some sort of a golden line or something where they filled it with oil and threw him in there. So if that's the case, that he was a faithful martyr who was a minister or a servant living in Pergamos and was killed in front of one of these temples, it would fulfill this about being killed where Satan dwells. But really, throughout this verse, what we find is that there are people during this Pergamos era who, despite the fact that the majority were turning into heretics and were amalgamating themselves politically, they were still those who held fast and did not. Let's go back now to 1 Samuel chapter 22. 1 Samuel chapter 22. We find that even in the third era of the Old Testament church, that there were people who did not follow Saul. They were people who understood their calling and what God wanted them to do and expected of them. In fact, many of them were Levites. During the time of Saul, the Levites did not support him for the most part. Saul was a Benjamite, and Benjamin, as you know in the book of Judges, had a pretty checkered history, certainly not following God like they should have. So in 1 Samuel chapter 22 and verse 6, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered, Saul, of course, at this time is chasing David. Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand, so all ready to go to kill David whenever he could find him, and all his servants standing with him. Saul said to his servants who stood about, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? You know, is David, if he becomes king instead of me, will he give you all land and offices and positions? All of you have conspired against me, and there's not one who reveals to me that my son made a covenant with the son of Jesse. There's not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." So Saul's whining, feeling sorry for himself, blaming them because no one's told him where David is retreated to. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, certainly one of the more evil dudes in the Old Testament, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, and to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." Now that sword belonged to David anyway, because David had killed Goliath, and that would be rightfully his sword. So the king sent to Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, my son of Ahitub. He answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, and you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait, as it is this day?" So here we have the king trying to find out why this priest had hidden, or at least given food to King David. In verse 16, the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." So here is a priest who did nothing more than give food to King David, and all of a sudden, King Saul wants him killed. So he would be a type of men who were later like Antipas, faithful martyrs who held fast to their truth, held fast to worshiping God, and paid for it with their life. The king said to the guards who stood about him, this is verse 17, "Turn and kill the priest of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me." Now this last part of verse 17 is interesting. It shows that these servants were not real anxious to kill Levites. They were not real anxious to kill the priests of God. The servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. So even though King Saul had turned into a very, almost a maniacal type person, to where he felt he was accountable to no one and even gone to demons to try to get direction. The people who were following him, a few of them still had a conscience and would not. The king said to Doeg, "You turn and kill the priests." So Doeg the Edomite, notice Doeg is not an Israelite. Doeg does not have the respect of the priesthood and the Levites that he should have. He instead was someone from Edom. Turn and struck the priests and kill on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. So 85 of God's priests were killed on that day. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and sheep and donkeys with the edge of the sword. So here we have these terrible destructions, terrible killing, murder of people by King Saul. And we find here this sort of a thread that goes all the way through the rulerships of Saul, of David, and of Solomon, of people who did hold fast to the truth and were not about to turn against it during that time. So here we have a similar man to Antipas. One of my favorite, I think, would be Uriah the Hittite, who was very faithful to David and to God, and he gave his life for being faithful to David and to God. Now let's go over to Revelation chapter 2 again and see what we have written here. The next thing said about the people in Pergamos. God has a few things against them. Many of them, of course, had gone the way of paganism. Many had held firm. But he says in verse 14, "I have a few things against you." So what are the things that God has against the Pergamos era? Two things. Number one, you have there those who told or hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality. So Balaam, as you understand the story from Numbers and a little bit later, Balaam tried to curse the people of Israel and God would not let him. Most of us recall, of course, the story of Balaam's donkey or Balaam's ass telling him not to do that, standing in his way, Balaam hitting him because he wanted him to get out of the way. But in reality, what Balaam did, since he was not able to curse Israel, is he went back to the Moabites and Edomites, and he said, the way to get Israel punished is to send your daughters in there, your women, entice them to sin in immorality, and then God himself will punish them. Now, sadly, that is the story of the third era of the Old Testament church. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11. For 300 years, between about 50 and about 325 AD, about 250 years, Satan tried persecutions. He tried chasing people, death, torture, but that only seemed to strengthen the church. Satan then began to change tactics. He began to infiltrate the church with the allure of the flesh. He did it successfully back in the time of David and later of Solomon. And apparently it also works on many Christians during the time of the Pergamos era. It certainly is something that is going on today, full steam ahead, as we see what's on our entertainment industry and how things have changed and the immorality that has completely engulfed this country in the last several decades. But in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 1, it happened in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed, walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So here David was king. He felt he had life and death authority over everyone. Being a king apparently swells your head. You don't have any concept of being accountable to a higher being, or David certainly had lost some of that. And so we know the story that there was adultery, there was immorality, that later the entire nation began paying penalties because Absalom's sister is wrong. Over in chapter 13, we have Tamar going into Amnon, and we have the first time we have pretty much a forcible immorality or a forcible rape situation. Verse 15, Amnon hated her exceedingly. So the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love which he had loved her. So we have David's children now getting involved in immorality and following the examples of the Edomites, in fact, the doctrine of Balaam. The same is true later with Absalom over in chapter 15. And then later, of course, Ahithophel, Absalom's counsel, all of the things that occurred during the time of David. David's immorality cost the nation of Israel thousands of dead, caused him to flee Jerusalem, caused, as it did in the later years of the Pergamos era, some very severe penalties upon the third and fourth and fifth generation. But perhaps the worst of all is over in 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11. You see, we have people in the church era of Pergamos who followed the stumbling block of Balaam. And we also have vivid illustration in the third era of the Old Testament, the time of the United Kingdom, that what destroyed the United Kingdom was the doctrine of Balaam, infiltrating the church or infiltrating God's people with the allure of the flesh, with sexual immorality. In 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 1, King Solomon loved many foreign women. Now, I don't believe this is agape love. This would be, lusted for is a better way to put it. As well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Notice here who some of these women were. Women of the Moabites. Well, what was Balaam? He was an Edomite, but that's next door. Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians. Who were the Sidonians? Well, remember Jezebel? She was a Sidonian. The Sidon was the center of Baal worship. And Hittites. That from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, for they will nor turn they with you. They will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in lust. That's all it amounts to. So here we have the greatest kingdom that was ever established in the Middle East. And for the first 20 years, King Solomon pretty much stayed on the straight and narrow. Now, God had appeared to him twice. He heard this big voice in the temple. He saw the fire and all the presence of God and heard all the sound and seen all the blessings. You would think that for the rest of his life, he would be trembling in fear to disobey God. But there's something that happens to a person's mind when they are accountable to no one, where they are kings, where they, as it's said of many today who are, quote, celebrities, they live in the land of rarefied air. They don't breathe the air the rest of us do, because all they ever get is, you know, celebrity worship and can I do this for you, can I do that for you, can I do something else for you, and no one ever raises a finger and says you were wrong. Some of the celebrities today that have been accused of heinous crimes still have, you know, thousands and thousands of supporters out there in front of the courthouse, you know, chanting, we love so-and-so, or he's great, we don't care what he's accused of, we know he's not guilty. Never could figure that out, you know. We don't care what he's accused of, we know he's not guilty, I'm sure of that. So King Solomon here, because he was king, lost his ability to reason, and believe it or not, in about 20 years he forgot that Almighty God had appeared to him and given him the wisdom that he asked for in his prayer. So instead he had all of these women. Solomon clung to these in lust. Verse 3, he had 700 wives. Now that would be impossible. I just can't imagine having 700 wives. I mean, what would you do with all the nylons? And how could you afford them? I mean, you think of all the things that wives require time-wise. You know, Mother's Day cards, you know, birthday presents, all these things, flowers, and, you know, all these hormonal changes. I mean, you can imagine, you know, 400 of them going through menopause at once. It'd just be unbelievable. So I don't think they had the husband-wife relationship like we think of. But still, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Notice his wives turned away his heart. So his relationship with these women, some of them Edomites and Moabites, who definitely had the doctrine of Balaam, they turned his heart away. The doctrine of Balaam is a message of compromise. Balaam was a prophet, but he was also covetous. When the Israelites rejected his offer, essentially God did, the plan was to mingle Moabite attractive women with the men of Israel and bring them down and teach them to worship their gods. Of course, they did. In the time of Numbers, 24,000 were killed by God. In the time of Solomon, when the exact same thing happened, the entire kingdom was torn in two. During the last 20 years of Solomon's reign, there was war after war after war. The first 20 years basically were times of peace. But God then began to bring other nations and other kings against him because he would not turn away from these pagan gods. In verse 5, Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. He built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill east of Jerusalem. Now, what hill is east of Jerusalem? It's the Mount of Olives. It's a place from which Jesus Christ ascended and to which he'll return. And yet Solomon built this abominable temple over there for Chemosh. And wherever these women wanted to have temples built, apparently he built them. And even that, he bowed down himself to them. Verse 8, he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So here we have sexual immorality, the doctrine of Balaam, completely destroying a king, virtually, and then of Yenophkes, of course, having his heart torn apart. Verse 12, nevertheless, I will not do it for your days. For the sake of your father David, I will tear it out of the hand of your son. So the kingdom was torn away. 10 tribes were torn away from Solomon's descendants because of the sin of the doctrine of Balaam. So we have during this time of the third church era of the Old Testament, the doctrine of Balaam that began to turn away the hearts of many people, and beginning with Solomon, of course. And during the time of the Pergamos church, we have it doing the same thing. Let's go back now to Revelation chapter 2, because we have the understanding of what was going on during that time. At least from history, we have a little bit of understanding of it. We see that the great church of Europe was emerging and becoming solid and eventually riding the beast and, of course, circulating a lot of its teachings and ideas, and so many people who once held fast to the truth and followed after it. Verse 15, this you also have, there thus you also have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Now, what is the doctrine of the Nicolaitans? Why does God hate it? We've always taught, most of us have heard, that this guy named Nicholas was a Middle East or Middle Ages god, a Greek god of mythology, who did things like keep Easter, keep Sunday, keep Valentine's Day, and essentially taught the pagan religion of pagan holidays as we understand it. That's probably true to a certain extent. But I will tell you what I believe the doctrine of the Nicolaitans is, and give you some reasons for that. Many of the commentaries say Nicholas was simply another form of Nimrod, and that the doctrine of Nimrod is that men should rule over other men, and in fact, men should be intermediaries between God and men. Nimrod's basic teaching was, you fall down and worship me, and then I will worship God on your behalf. You all fall down, worship me, do what I say, give me your possessions, and I will go into the temple, and I will offer a sacrifice on your behalf. So if that's the case, the theory or the idea of Nicolaitans is that no longer are people able to go directly to God, but instead they have to go to a man. And during this time we have an entire system of the church in Europe where people began to be taught that they had to go to a certain priesthood, and the priesthood would make indulgences for them, and the priesthood would absolve them of their sins. And these certain priests would then do whatever they do over their dead bodies, so that the person who had dead was deceased could then go to purgatory or go on to heaven. So we had this entire system set up during that time, which said that men come between you and God, and you have to worship those men in the way that they say, and they then can worship God on your behalf. Of course, that's very contrary to Scripture. In Scripture, we have very plainly in Hebrews, let us come boldly before the throne. God says very plainly, he is close to all of those that hear him, and each one of us should bring our own offering to the altar of God, and that the pastor, the ministers are helpers of our joy, but they are not in the place of, they are not vicars of Christ. So we have those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans in this case, historically, very obviously, which thing I hate. Now, during the time of the Old Testament, or the third era of the Old Testament church, we have the kings establishing themselves, first Saul, then David, then Solomon, and many began to worship them instead of worshiping God himself. And in fact, the idea of Nicolaitanism, which meant men ruling over men and having control over other men, became the downfall of, or one part of the downfall of, ancient Israel, because the kings that came after Solomon were almost to a man very evil. There were a few that were not, perhaps men like Hezekiah, Josiah, perhaps the last good ruler of any of them. But for the most part, the rulership of the kings of Israel is a sad history, a very sad history of disobeying God, of becoming very narcissistic and self-absorbed, and of abusing and hurting the people of Israel. So we have the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which obviously came to the front, became very, very accepted in the continent of Europe during the time when the Church of Europe began to be dominant. Now notice over in chapter 2, we have the Church of Ephesus, that they, in verse 6, says, "This you have, you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate." Now the Nicolaitans, in the time of the Ephesus era, were the followers of Simon Magus, who were trying to establish this priestly intermediary for Christians, who were trying to establish that you should worship them because they were doing magic tricks, and you could then worship them. They were some great one, it says. Simon Magus said he was some great one. So people should worship them, and they could go do worshiping for God. So the idea of the Nicolaitans didn't fly in the Ephesus area, but later it did, beginning in the 300s A.D. Pergamos had become corrupted, so that many of those people began to buy into the idea of there being intermediaries of men between God and men. With the tactics being changed here, what we find is a church that gradually became part of the world, and even the remnant true church of God became persecuted because so many of them left or wanted to be part of the world. Let's go back to James chapter 4 and verse 4. The lesson here for all of us is very obvious, that people want a king. People want to worship a man. You can see a man, you can hear him, you can talk to him, you can, or a woman, either one, you can see how, you know, you can admire how good looking they are, you can depend on them for your protection if you're under a threat. So it's easy for people to want a king. And even in the times in which we live, there are still people who are part of God's truth who want a king, who still want a man to be an intermediary or a ruler for them. The Bible doesn't teach it. Nowhere did Jesus Christ teach it. He said, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." So we have at the right hand of God our high priest, who is our intermediary. But oftentimes people, because of our weaknesses, we want to enthrone a man. We want to have some man that we can look at and have sometimes an organization or a form of government that borderlines on Nicolaitanism. In James chapter 4 and verse 4, "Adulterers and adulteresses," so James was writing to both, male and female, "do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God?" So you can't be friends with the world. We can't have a system that's like the world's and also have a system that is God's. We can't half worship God during the day and then half worship the world later. "Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." You know, Pergamos meant married to or a friend of the world. And that's what happened during that time. "Do you think the scripture says in vain, the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealousy, therefore he gives more grace? He says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." So the friendship of the world is at enmity with God. And that was the big challenge that the Pergamos people, by and large, failed. Let's go to Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. This also may be why during this time, very little was done in the way of evangelizing. Oh, there were colonies throughout Europe, especially Northern Europe, perhaps over into what was the Orthodox Eastern Empire. Small groups of Sabbath keepers, of those who kept the holy days. We have in history certain evidences of those things. And later, during the time of the next church era, during the Spanish Inquisition, we have the story of the Roman government and certainly the Roman church trying to ferret out and get rid of Sabbath keepers in their empire. So we know they were out there and they were scattered. They were not highly visible, but also they were not doing much except just barely keeping alive because of their desire, apparently, to be friends with the world. God didn't use them to do many big things. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And in verse 2, don't be conformed to this world. The Living Bible, which is really a transliteration, not a translation, says, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its mold. And that was the biggest problem with the Pergamos era, and in fact, the biggest problem with the third era of the Old Testament church. They wanted to be like the nations around them. They wanted to have a king. Eventually wanted to worship the same gods as the nations around them. They didn't want to feel like they were different. They were odd. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. So some may claim that the 4th century in the time of Constantine was a great victory for the church. In reality, it was a great defeat. They had actually stayed pretty solid during the time of the great persecution. Many gave their life. Many were thrown to lions. Many were taken to the circuses, which were the big colosseums where they were put in with gladiators and animals. But they held fast. It was when they were allowed freedom and allowed friendship and seduced with adultery of the world and also sexual adultery, and then they saw the opportunity to become people of importance in this new church that was forming in Europe to make the Roman Empire come together. That's what caused the real problems in the church of the Pergamos era. Let's go back now to Revelation chapter 2. He has a couple things now to say. He gives them some advice on what to do. Some of this I think we ought to take to heart. Verse 16, he says, repent, or else I will come to you quickly and fight against them with the sword of my mouth. Now, who is them? Who is them that has the sword that he's going to fight against? Well, them refers back to verse 15. That is those who hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. So in a sense, verse 16 is prophetic because someday Jesus Christ will return and will fight with the sword of his mouth against the image of the beast. Remember Revelation 19? Jesus Christ returns on a white horse. Out of his mouth goes a sharp two-edged sword that will strike the nations with. Revelation 19 and verse 15. So someday he will come back and will fight against them, meaning those who have the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, those who teach that men are intermediaries between God and man, that Jesus Christ isn't really our intermediary, that some other man is. So we have those people who will someday be destroyed, or at least be defeated by Jesus Christ. So what we're warning here, being warned here in Pergamos, is you'd better repent, or else you're going to be a part of that other side, perhaps. I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. And then he says in verse 17, let him who has an ear hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So you better be able to listen. Some people in Pergamos apparently were not able to listen. Their friendship with the world had clouded their hearing and their thinking, and they were simply not able to hear what the Spirit was saying to the churches. But he says this, to him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat. Now, what do we have to overcome in this context? Well, overcoming Nicolaitanism, overcoming the doctrine of Balaam, overcoming the friendship of the world. And the word overcoming in the Greek means to conquer, to prevail, to be victorious. It's used over in Romans chapter 8 and verse 37. Let's turn over there, where Paul says we can be complete conquerors and tells us how. So if we are going to hear what the Spirit says to the churches, and to overcome and eat that spiritual manna, this says how we to do it, how we are to do it. Romans chapter 8 and verse 37. In all of these things, we are more than conquerors, or we are complete conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither life nor death nor angels nor principalities nor powers nor things present nor things to come nor height or depth nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. So nothing can separate us from God, not persecutions, not governments, not being sick, not being without enough clothes, not being cold. The only thing that can separate us from God is our own sin. But he says we can be more than conquerors as long as we do it through the strength of him who loved us. Then he says, of course, he will give of him to eat of the hidden manna. Let's go over to John chapter 6. So we have to first be overcoming with God's help. And hand in hand with that, we have John chapter 6 about Jesus Christ being the bread of life. These people had to eat of Jesus Christ every day if they were going to endure the temptation, the political system, and the corruption that overcame the church during the 300s and 400s A.D. And indeed, we found in our own time many people who had quit studying, quit praying, quit using their lifeline to God, and they indeed went the same path as the church in Pergamos. John chapter 6 and verse 48 says, I am the bread of life. We just read that he's going to give us that hidden manna to eat. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. That manna that came down every day was a type of Jesus Christ feeding us in the wilderness. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. So we are to eat of it not once a month, not once a week, but every day. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. So Jesus Christ very plainly said that he was like manna coming from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. So we have very plainly this manna that Jesus Christ said we should eat daily if we are to overcome the temptations that Pergamos faced. Now the last mention here in this verse, in Revelation chapter 2, after he says to him who overcomes, he'll have some manna to eat. The next thing he says is, I will give him a white stone. I'll give him a white stone. Now, what was a white stone, say, as opposed to a black or a brown stone? Well, a white stone has been used down through the years to accept people into a society, a club, a group, or even a family. If any of you were ever in Masonic organizations, or like Demolay or Job's Daughters or Masonic organizations, and they had these initiations, you first had to go through some sort of an interview and then being recommended or sponsored by a member. And then there was a little box with a hole in it. And down below this box, there was a large group of marbles. And they were black, a few black, mostly white. And I remember going as a Demolay kid when I was younger, you know, going up in my robe along with everybody else, and you'd grab a stone and put it in a little round marble and put it in the little hole. And if someone was rejected, it was because they were blackballed. They got a black stone instead of a white one. You've heard of the term being blackballed. What that means, someone who knows you has some dirt on you, so he blackballs you or puts the blackball in the box, which means you cannot become a member of this society or group or family unit. So when Jesus Christ says, I will give you a white stone if you overcome, and if you eat of the hidden manna, he's saying, you will then be accepted into my family. You will be accepted into our society or our club or our group, so to speak. So if you do all of those things, I will give you membership in this new group. And it says, on the stone is a new name written, which no one knows it except him who receives it. So no one else can understand this stone except the person who receives it. So Jesus Christ said very plainly to the people who endure the persecutions of Pergamos, who overcome and eat of the hidden manna of Jesus Christ, they would then have membership in this most exclusive of all clubs. They'll have a white stone, which then means they can become part of the family of God. And on that stone is a name. Let's go over to Isaiah chapter 62, where that name is mentioned on that stone. Isaiah 62, beginning in verse 1. Before I do, I want to read some more about the history of what happened later. As you know, we had in 700 years of very volatile European history, we have the story of Julian, we have Augustine of Hippo, we have so many things happening during that time. The major event, though, that occurred next in the time of the Pergamos church, in the early 7th century, so in the early 600s, it seemed that order was about to be restored. For 400 years, since the 200s, the invaders had gone all across Europe. We had Attila the Hun, we had the Ostrogoths, the Heruli, the Magars, many, many others. And the empire had been a constant state of battle, of war, of turmoil, of fighting for position. And finally, in the early 600s, it looked like the world had finally obtained peace. The Franks from the beginning had been converted to the faith. The Arian invaders had embraced the Nicene Orthodoxy. In the British Isles, the trip of Augustine paid off. There was peace in Britain. The Byzantine Empire still enjoyed many of the results of Justinian's conquest. North Africa was quiet. The Vandal Kingdom had disappeared. So in the early 600s, for a number of years, it looked like there was peace in Europe. Then something unexpected happened. Out of Arabia, a forgotten corner of the world that had been ignored by the Roman and Persian empires, a tidal wave of conquest arose that threatened to engulf the world. In a few years, the Persian Empire had vanished, and many of the ancient Roman territories were in Arab lands. The driving force behind this human avalanche was Muhammad, an Arab merchant who had always had religious interests, who had come into contact with both Judaism and the various Christian sects that had existed in Arabia, some of them rather unorthodox. His message, which he claimed had been revealed to him by Gabriel, was that of a single God, both just and merciful, who rules over all things and requires obedience from all men. His message was posed in rhythmic fashion. Muhammad claimed that he was not preaching a new religion, but simply the culmination of what God had been revealing in the Hebrew prophets and in Jesus, who also was a prophet. The leadership resulted in many invasions. These invasions had enormous significance in Christianity. All of Spain pretty much was taken, except for the very top, all of the northern part of Africa, all the way up to the Pyrenees in Western Europe. Finally, the Arabs were defeated at the Battle of Tours in 732 in central France. These invasions resulted in this. Huge areas of what was the center of Christianity were now in Arab lands under Muslim rule. Jerusalem, Antioch, Damascus, Alexandria, Carthage. What was the Christian world and the center of Christianity for 400 or 500 years now became Muslim. And so the church had to move to the west, and all of those lands that had at one time been the center of Christianity were now under Muslim rule. In Carthage and the surrounding area, Christianity completely disappeared. In the rest of the vast Arab holdings, it was tolerated but ceased growing. The Byzantine Empire, which until then had vast territories in the Near East, in the northern coast of Africa, was pushed back to what is now Turkey and some small holdings in Europe. Above all, the entire geographic configuration of Christianity changed. Until then, Christianity had developed along the Mediterranean basin. Christianity was a Mediterranean religion. Now it would have to go north, find along an axis going from north to south, from the Frankish kingdom, Italy, to the British Isles. Constantinople was alienated from that axis. It is no coincidence that a few years after the Arab conquest, in AD 800, the Pope felt inclined to crown Charlemagne, Emperor of the West, in order to try to stop this onslaught of Arabs from the East. And so we have the entire Christian world moving to the West and to the North. And by the time at the end of the Pergamos era, we have about 120 years of Christianity striking back in what was called the Crusades. Because in about 1000 AD, the Pope then and many of the leaders of Europe said, we've had it with all these Arabs taking over what was the traditional Christian lands, all the Middle East, Antioch, Carthage, all those areas, especially Jerusalem, and they sent armies down, wave after wave, what were called the Crusades, to try to rescue those lands from those people. And of course, it only worked for a few years. So at the beginning of the Pergamos era, we have Constantine the Great giving his blessing on Christianity and using that religion to build the Roman Empire. At the end of the Pergamos era, we have the Crusades, because the Crusades are a reaction against these hordes of Arabs that have been menacing the known world and attacking Europe for almost 300 years by that time, 350 years actually. So the Pergamos era spanned a fascinating time in history, and during that time, the great danger for the church was spiritual immorality, physical immorality, and of course, becoming a friend with the world, because they didn't want to be different. A lot of lessons, and as we see the time of Thyatira dawning about the year 1000 or 1100, there's certainly a new era coming in Europe and a new era coming in the church. Isaiah chapter 62, we find here about this white stone, this new name that we shall be given if we overcome and if we have the daily manna of Jesus Christ. It says, for Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until her righteousness goes forth as brightness, and her salvation as a lamp that burns. The Gentiles shall see your righteousness, and all kings your glory. That's obviously in a future world tomorrow, a future time of God's kingdom on the earth. You shall be called by a new name. That new name on that stone, that white stone, which means membership in God's family. And a new name written on it, which is your family name now. By which the mouth of the Lord will name. So we don't know what that new name will be. God will give it to us. You shall also be a crown of glory in the hand of the Lord and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. So you'll be sharing in the crown and throne of Jesus Christ if you overcome the same things that the people in Pergamos were warned about overcoming, and that was friendship with the world, spiritual adultery, and certainly then the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, having a man between you and Jesus Christ.